from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point from Charlotte, North Carolina, and the Democratic National Convention. Whatever people think of the Obama years so far, no one denies that the president's had a full plate, actually two full plates, at home, an economy that began in freefall, abroad, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Bin Laden, Arab Spring, China rising, Iran and Israel threatening war, now Syria in flames. Just for starters, this hour on Point, the president abroad, Obama's way in the world. And we'll take a look at that Clinton speech last night as well. You can join the conversation. How do you rate Barack Obama, President Obama, on foreign policy? Are we better off than we were 4 years ago on the global stage? Would Mitt Romney do better? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a great crew of world watchers with us this hour. But first, Bill Clinton last night. It was a big speech to Democrats and the country that's had everybody talking. John Meacham joins us in just a second. Let's listen for just a moment to Bill Clinton on that stage, back in the limelight for Barack Obama last night.
I want to nominate a man who's cool on the outside, but who burns for America on the inside. I want a man who believes, with no doubt, that we can build a new American dream economy driven by innovation and creativity, by education, and yes, by cooperation. And by the way, after last night, I want a man who had the good sense to marry Michelle Obama.
Bill Clinton last night talking cool, talking Michelle, emotion and a lot of ideas from the podium at the same time. John Meacham joins us. He was listening, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Andrew Jackson, former editor of Newsweek, now executive editor at Random House. John, thanks for being here. What did you hear? What did you see on that stage last night, John?
Well, Tom, I think we saw what is now the longest-running act in American politics, without any question. I was thinking, as I watched, how interesting it is that the Democratic Party, which prides itself on its progressivism and its grassroots, is in fact the only party with true patriarchs at this point in the Clinton family. The Republicans have the Bushes, but nobody really wants at least the 43rd president around very much these days. But there's Bill Clinton, 20 years after his own nomination, 24 years after he nominated Michael Dukakis, really playing a kind of FDR-like role. President Roosevelt used to talk about the role of the president as educator-in-chief, and thought of himself in the mode of Endicott Peabody, the rector of Groton, who had been his schoolmaster. And Bill Clinton had everything except a PowerPoint presentation and a whiteboard.
It was a teaching kind of moment. It was a lawyerly kind of case, almost, that he made for Barack Obama last night. He had his President Elvis emotion and moves and talking cool. When do you hear a president say that in front of a big crowd?
Exactly. And, and it's depending on where you stand, it was either Matt Locke or Atticus Finch. There are all sorts of cultural analogies here. But to my mind, it was a very grown-up speech that took the audience's intelligence seriously. Mm-hmm. And we don't see enough of that in politics. And I don't understand why, because, boy, does it work. When people think you're giving them credit for being able to follow a three-point argument, I think it works very, very well.
John, you've studied presidents through history. A lot of people talking today about, wow, he laid out the case. He gave the narrative in a way that people say, well, even the president, sitting president himself, has not done. Why is that so hard? Why does it take what people are today calling a master to tell the story of an administration? Why is that challenge so high, John?
Well, I think it's hard. Well, it's a tough story. Let's start first of all, no matter who's telling it, because you're asking for something politically that's very hard to achieve, which is you want credit for what didn't happen. That is, you want points for not having made things worse,
for not having a depression.
Yeah, and well, intellectually, I think a lot of us believe that and follow it. it is true that in an electorate this big and the way American politics tends to work, it's a tougher case to say you may not be better off than you were, but you would be a hell of a lot worse off if, you know, you get into again, it's a paragraph, not a sentence. And when you get into the politics of the paragraph, you want Bill Clinton representing your side. And I think it's tough. I think the president or any president who has to defend himself or someday herself can risks coming off as defensive. Where it's why, you know, mm-hmm. we have lawyers represent cases, and mm-hmm. so I know that if I get in trouble, I'm going to call Bill Clinton.
Well, that was some lawyer on the stand last night, or in the well anyway, some speech. Americans really buzzing about it. We'll see how that narrative bleeds into the campaign trail narrative and how it shows up in the polls. John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential biographer, joining us today, author of American Lion. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted. Thank you.
Okay, let's go global. Look at Obama in the world. Get some global perspective. With me now in Charlotte is Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for the international Arabic daily Al-Hayat. Joyce, thank you very much for being here in Charlotte.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us here, Ed Luce, chief U.S. commentator and Washington correspondent for Britain's Financial Times. He's author of Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. Ed, great to have you back. Thanks for being here in Charlotte today.
Thanks, Tom.
And finally, from Boston, all by his lonesome in the studio where I usually sit, David Sanger joins us, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David Sanger, welcome. Wonderful to have you with us.
Tom, great to be here all alone in your studio. We're thinking about running a silent studio coup here. You know?
I think it'll be all yours today. Have at it. Ed Luce, give us a little perspective first from across the pond. Here's this president. He's just about at the end of his 4 years, maybe first 4 years. We'll know that in November. You've watched American presidents for a while now. What stands out about Barack Obama and his posture toward the world, his attitude, his foreign policy?
And I think in contrast to what the debate here sometimes suggests, he's pretty popular around the world, more popular perhaps in Europe than in the Middle East, mm-hmm. Pretty popular in places like China and India. He's seen as having changed the tone of America's foreign policy posture towards the world since the 8 Bush years. He's seen as being a more discursive, reasonable person who's prepared to talk, reach out, seek cooperation.
Mitt Romney says apologize. Is that how he's seen abroad? He's the American president who apologized, or something different from that?
No, I don't think. I mean, people are aware that that's what Romney has branded Obama as. I think they're also, people do pay attention to American presidential elections, and I think they're also aware that he's not actually used that word. The Cairo speech of 2009 that Joyce, I'm sure, can talk about, mm-hmm. is the one that I think Romney has in mind. But the apology word wasn't used. Mm-hmm. I think his ratings are pretty high. There is perhaps some surprise internationally at the degree of continuity in terms of the global war on terror. That term, global mm-hmm. war on terror, is no longer in
George
use.
George Bush's policy, if not phrasing.
If not phrasing, exactly. And the drone attacks, there is unease about the degree to which extralegality continues to be a feature of Obama's Washington, as it was of George W. Bush's.
And beyond the man himself, American standing, American, I don't know, power, respect in the world in the Obama years?
It's gone up, perhaps not as dramatically as you would expect, and unevenly. In Europe, mm-hmm. it's very much gone up, and it's stayed up. It hasn't really, as I say, there's controversy about drones, but generally it's up markedly. In other parts of the world, it's up, but not as much as you would expect. And, of course, in some parts of the world, like Pakistan and Turkey, it's down.
Let's hear a little bit from that famous Cairo speech you just referenced. I'll bring it to you, Joyce. But this was June 2009. President Obama, pretty new to his presidency, expressing his global commitment to democracy, but stressing that America would not dictate terms. A tone was set and noticed.
No system of government can or should be imposed by one nation by any other. That does not lessen my commitment, however, to governments that reflect the will of the people. Each nation gives life to this principle in its own way, grounded in the traditions of its own people. America does not presume to know what is best for everyone, just as we would not presume to pick the outcome of a peaceful election.
America does not presume to know what's best for everyone. Barack Obama, Cairo, June 2009. Joyce, what about American standing in the region that your newspaper is so associated with, the Middle East? There has been this effort to there was an effort to reach out to Iran. There have been moves in many directions here, out of Iraq, still strong and big in Afghanistan still. Is American standing up, down, or sideways in the Middle East in the Obama years?
Well, I think when you look to the Middle East, when you talk to Arabs, when Obama came to office, they had very high hopes for the president. They listened to him in Cairo. They had high hopes for the peace process. They had high hopes for closing Guantanamo, and they had high hopes for trying to reach a negotiated settlement with Iran. Looking at all these points today, there's a sense of disappointment that Mr. Obama has not delivered either on the peace process or on Guantanamo or Iran. However, I think the president does get point in the Arab street, mainly on ending the Iraq war that was highly unpopular across the Arab world. He also gets high points for changing the tone on how to address Middle East issues. You don't hear any more words like Islamofascism or Islamic terrorism coming
behind
from the
us right now. Joyce Karam, please stand by. Ed Luce, David Sanger will come to you right after the break. We're talking about Barack Obama and the world. This is Tom Ashbrook with On Point in Charlotte. I'm Tom Ashbrook in Charlotte at the Democratic National Convention, and this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Barack Obama and the world, Obama's imprint, America's standing in the Obama years. Ed Luce joins us from the Financial Times, Joyce Karam of the International Arabic Daily Al Hayat, and David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times, is here. It certainly wasn't all restraint under Obama, a surge in Afghanistan, intervention in Libya, and this, May 2011, the president strode to television cameras in the White House to make this announcement.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
That got everybody's attention, and the Obama administration has made sure that we've all heard about it again and again. David Sanger, Mitt Romney, last week in Tampa, saying, this president has not stood tall enough. I will spend more. I will lead more. I will make America more at the center, more out front on global issues. Is that a reasonable critique of this president, or is Mitt Romney just looking for something to say about foreign policy?
Well, it's certainly harder, Tom, for Mitt Romney to make a foreign policy critique against the president than an economic critique. I think 3.5 years ago, no one would have thought that possible. But think about where we were 3.5 years ago and where we are today and what we've learned about Barack Obama along the way. So when he came to office on January 20th, 2009, there were roughly 170,000 American troops deployed between Iraq and Afghanistan, far more of them in Iraq than Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. As he accepts the nomination tonight, the number is closer to 70,000. So he's down by about 100 out of Iraq and making their way out of Afghanistan, although a big question about whether or not there should be an enduring presence there. The surprise of Obama's presidency, and really the you mentioned confront and conceal, and the reason I went off to write that book was this has been a foreign policy of surprises. The surprise is that he has embraced many of the techniques of the Bush era, as Ed mentioned before, in the service of sort of a new Obama doctrine, which is that the days of doing these big attritional wars where you send 100,000 troops in and you spend $500 billion and you breed the resentment of the country you're occupying, those days are over. And I think that reflects very much the electorate. So when Mr. Romney comes out and says, you know, he wants America to be out there and big and in charge, it raises the question, even with some of his own advisors, well, what does that mean? Stay in Afghanistan and fight to every last Taliban member? You know, we've been working at this for 11 or 12 years, and it's had its limits.
Well,
So I think that that is that's the challenge for Romney, and I think the challenge for the president is to make the case that this new light footprint approach of relying on drones and cyber war, as you and I have discussed, and special forces can accomplish his goals without having that kind of occupation.
Light footprint, but certainly lethal nevertheless. Here's Mitt Romney mocking Obama. This was last week in Tampa for what he said was going on an apology tour when he took office, for talking with Iran while the centrifuges and its nuclear program kept spinning there, for abandoning American friends. He said more backbone is what's required. Here's Romney.
President Obama has thrown allies like Israel under the bus, even as he has relaxed sanctions on Castro's Cuba. He abandoned our friends in Poland by walking away from our missile defense commitments. But he's eager to give Russia's President Putin the flexibility he desires after the election. Under my administration, our friends will see more loyalty, and Mr. Putin will see a little less flexibility and more backbone.
Mitt Romney in Tampa last week. Ed Luce, I imagine you were listening to that. What did you think of that key paragraph there in his speech on America's, the Romney-era posture in the world if he should become president?
Well, my suspicion about Romney is, I think probably quite widely shared, is that he talks a very tough game on foreign policy. It doesn't actually get that much traction in this election. This is not a foreign policy election in any shape or form.
It's an economy election.
It's an economy election. An event, God forbid, might change that, but unless that happens, it's not going to be a foreign policy election. My suspicion, though, about Romney is that he's actually a moderate, that if he did come to office, that people like Bob Zelik, who he's appointed as, you know, his national security advisor and the former Bush Deputy Secretary of State, who's very much in the sort of Jim Baker mainstream realist Republican foreign policy tradition, would be governing it more than, say, the John Boltons who we hear a lot of. The neocons and the hardline nationalists who we hear a lot of around and about the Romney campaign, but whom I suspect are there really to keep the base satisfied that Romney really is a conservative.
So you'd see him in the mold of what president, perhaps? If not Obama, George W. Bush, or somebody else? He likes to cite Reagan, who you know,
well, I mean, it
what's
would
the antecedent
be,
to that Romney foreign policy?
I suppose I could say George H.W. Bush more than George W. Bush, but of course George H.W. Bush was a man of great foreign policy experience.
Former head
and
of the
judgment.
CIA, really knew it. Mitt Romney?
Mitt Romney has, as far as I can tell, zero foreign policy experience. And even at Bain, very few of these companies, other than the offshoring, were actually international deals. And, of course, Paul Ryan has zero foreign policy experience. So it would be a little bit unfair to George Bush Sr. to compare Romney to him. But in terms of his stance, being realist, pragmatic, wanting to focus on the economy, that's clearly what his agenda would be if he was taking office next January.
More than the rest of the world, and yet a president or a candidate for the presidency has to talk about it. Joyce Karam, when Mitt Romney talks about Israel being thrown under the bus and America, you know, with a kind of more large and in charge leadership role in the world, how does that strike Middle Eastern ears?
I mean, it definitely comes as a shock to Middle Easterners who think Obama actually threw the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, under the bus. They look at the Romney campaign with a lot of concern. Basically, they look at the Mitt Romney trip to the global trip where he actually didn't
London,
visit...
London, Israel, Jerusalem.
Poland, and he didn't actually visit any Arab country, and he didn't even go to Ramallah to meet with President Mahmoud Abbas. This is contrary to what we saw from John McCain, who actually visited Jordan, and from President Obama. There is also a few names on the Romney campaign that raises alarms in the Arab street, mainly Lebanese Americans like Mr. Walid Faris, who is known about his jihadist views and perceptions about Arabs.
He has a what kind of advisory
he's
role?
He's an advisor to the campaign. There has been calls from many Arabs to drop him, and that hasn't happened. There is also, they hear from Mr. Romney, you know, a more welcoming tone perhaps on Syria, that he would do more. But when it comes to substance, We don't know what are the details of his Syria plan. His advisors met last week with the Syrian opposition in Tampa, and they told them that the no-fly zone is not on the table right now.
An American-imposed or international-imposed no-fly zone over Assad's government.
Is not on the table, mm-hmm. So that brings us back to what Ed is saying. So perhaps his policy would be more a pragmatic approach to the problems of the Middle East. But so far, his tone on Israel and the Palestinians comes very disappointing to the Arab
world. And what about on Iran? Here's where Mitt Romney has looked to draw a stark line between his would-be policy and President Obama's policy. He's talked much tougher about that. Who knows where it'll end up? Let's listen for just a second. This was back in February, but this was a CNN-sponsored primary debate in Mesa, Arizona, telling CNN's John King here that America would prevent Iran under him from gaining from going forward with the nuclear program.
This is a president who should have instead communicated to Iran that we are prepared, that we are considering military options. They're not just on the table, they are in our hand. We must not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. If they do, the world changes, America will be at risk, and someday nuclear weaponry will be used. If I'm president, that will not happen. If we reelect Barack Obama, it will happen.
David Sanger, I'll come back to Joyce on that, but first to you. I mean, that was a stark claim. You know, if I'm president, they won't. But if Barack Obama is reelected, there will be nuclear weaponry, and it will be used. What about Romney versus Obama on Iran, David?
Well, sounds a lot tougher. When you dig beneath it and you ask the Romney campaign what they would do differently, you don't get a whole lot more than things that the president has already done. President Obama's done, I think it's fair to say, much tougher economic sanctions against Iran than happened at any point during the Bush administration, including now a cutoff in some, not all, of their oil revenue. The biggest program that was underway, I don't think Mr. Romney even knew about at the time that he made those statements in February. It was Olympic Games, which was the covert program to undermine the Iranian centrifuges with a cyber worm, mm-hmm. Popularly known as Stuxnet, once it got out.
Right.
There are differing opinions about how effective it was, whether it bought a year's delay, an 18-month delay. Some in the intelligence agencies say a 2-year delay. Whatever it brought about, what it told you was that while President Obama was reaching out with the open hand he discussed during the campaign of engagement with Iran, he was assembling the sanctions and then starting up the world's largest sustained cyber attack of a state against a state in history.
But David, when people hear Romney say that, and he repeated it again later, I mean,
right.
There are many who think to themselves, well, does it mean Romney, war with Iran? Obama, no war with Iran? Is there something as stark as that being suggested here or not?
Well, it may be being suggested, but, you know, most of the foreign policy experts I talked to, and I was with a number of them this summer who were on both sides of the aisle, including some advisors to Mr. Romney, seem to take the position that if both Iran and the U.S. stay on their current path, there's some kind of conflict in the offing in the next few years. And I think that's probably true no matter which president it is. Here is the big difference, though. More recently, since that clip that you played, mm-hmm. Mr. Romney has said that he would never strike a deal with Iran that allowed Iran to continue to enrich any kind of nuclear fuel, any kind of uranium, for example, even at low levels. While President Obama, I guess sensing the Iranians have both a legal right and probably would never agree to give up all enrichment, has put on the table with the Iranians a deal that would stop the most dangerous enrichment and allow a low level to continue. Mm-hmm. And that is the one real difference I've seen between the two men.
Ed Luce, Iran, the U.S., and war. Look at these two men and the policies they're talking. Obama, as he's exercised his role, Romney, as he imagines his. Do you see a more likely path one way or another? David Sanger is talking about it, almost an inevitability, perhaps, here, no matter who's president next time. Do you buy that?
I do. I would see David's greatly superior knowledge on this. But I think that the point that David just made, that Romney wouldn't permit anything under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to Iran, any kind mm-hmm. of enrichment, mm-hmm. is pushing a Romney administration far closer to an Israeli red line than the Obama administration is on this. And so I do, I mean, this
closer
would be
to the
one,
Israeli position.
Yes, this would be, Iran would be the one great caveat I would have to the point I was making earlier about Romney being very much a domestically focused, non-adventurist president. Perhaps adventure will be forced on him, both by his past commitments, but also by his closeness to Israel.
Hard for many Americans to contemplate perhaps another war in a next term. I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran is a big, big country. Joyce, as you look at it, between Obama, you've seen the track he's been on, Romney, you know, which looks more likely for bombs away over Iran, or can that be avoided?
I mean, it's really hard to predict, Tom, because you need to think, what will the Iranians do? Will they compromise? Iran right now is in a weaker stance in the region. Its ally Hezbollah in Lebanon is backed in a corner. Bashar al-Assad is struggling with a one-year revolution, and it doesn't look like he can hold up for much longer. So while I think, you know, the rhetoric from both campaigns will be harsher on Iran now, I think what the policy dictates in the next 4 years will be up to what Iran will agree on enrichment, what Iran will do in Syria or in Lebanon or in other places in the Middle
East. You
think
Iran will back down, all the way down, close it down entirely, which seems to be almost what Romney's requiring here, or enough to satisfy President Obama?
I think when you hear to some figures who used to be in the Obama administration, like Mr. Dennis Ross, who actually dealt with Iran, and he tells you that an agreement with Iran with a low enrichment, maybe 3.5%, is doable, and Israel might actually be okay with it.
With a low level kind of civilian use nuclear program
enrichment, and if you look at the Obama team, I mean, we still have Bill Burns, who was with the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. He is the one handling the negotiations with Iran. So again, I think decisions related to a big issue like war with Iran, both parties have to be very pragmatic on this issue, because it's not Iraq. It's not Syria. I mean, we're talking, you know, about a very powerful country in the Middle East, and, you know, the threat itself concerns many regional countries as well.
David Sanger, why do you think it comes to arms, perhaps either way, Obama or Romney?
Well, I think, you know, we forget in this, because we're so wrapped up in our own election, that the Iranians get a vote out here, and the Israelis get a vote out here. And, you know, the whole purpose of the diplomacy, the sanctions, and the covert action over the past few years has been twofold. One, to slow the Iranian program. I don't think anybody that I know thinks you can stop the Iranian program or stop them from getting a capability, at least at some point. You might stop them from an actual weapon. And the second is to slow Israel so that it does not go off with an attack on Iran that would plunge us into another war. That was the purpose of the Olympic Games sabotage effort, which was a joint program with Iran, with Israel. Against Iran. The project was to give the Israelis a way to try to slow Iran's progress without doing an attack. And so that's the big guessing game. And, you know, a week ago, there was a lot of chatter about whether or not there would be an Israeli attack before the election. Because Prime Minister Netanyahu may well calculate that if he attacks before the election, President Obama has no choice but to back him because of the electoral implications.
Is that concern still on or cooled off, David?
I think that concern is still real, but it's probably not a highly likely possibility.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, coming to you this week from Charlotte, North Carolina, in the Democratic National Convention. We are in the hall right now. President Obama will be here tonight for his big speech. It was supposed to be in an outdoor stadium before, 60, 70,000 plus people. Weather, it looks like, may not cooperate, and it's going to be moved right back in here. Ed Luce is with us from the Financial Times. His new book is Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. Joyce Haram is here, Washington correspondent for the International Arabic Daily, Al Hayat. And David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, is here, author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American power. Here was the president. This was December 2009. Big moment in his foreign policy. Gave an address at West Point where he outlined his administration's grand strategy on the war in Afghanistan and announced his own troop surge.
We will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010, the fastest possible pace, so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers.
Well, some of that has worked, some of it hasn't, and now everybody looking at America getting out, and there's a timetable. Tammy Duckworth, former Assistant Secretary in the Department of Veterans Affairs, candidate for U.S. Congress in Illinois, and an Iraq War vet who lost both legs in combat, spoke at this convention, the Democrats' convention on Tuesday, around Afghanistan on the choice between President Obama and Mitt Romney as Commander-in-Chief.
We have a clear choice on November 6th. Last week, Mitt Romney had a chance to show his support for the brave men and women he is seeking to command. But he chose to criticize President Obama instead of even uttering the word Afghanistan. Barack Obama will never ignore our troops. He will fight for them. That's why he is my choice on November 6th.
Lots of talk about troops at both conventions. Very little about Afghanistan. Ed Luce, your own country, the UK, has had its significant involvement there as well. What about the Obama surge? It's got to be a key point in assessing his foreign policy. It was a big decision on his part. He's called this the necessary war. Now he's looking at, you know, the exits. What about Obama and Afghanistan, Ed?
Well, I mean, I think if he hadn't managed to kill bin Laden, we would be focusing a lot more on Afghanistan now, a lot more harshly and a lot more critically, because, of course, the whole premise of Obama's original election in 2008 was that Bush had fought the wrong war. This is the right
Al-Qaeda.
War. And killing bin Laden is immensely helpful politically for Obama to give him cover to withdraw from Afghanistan, because this was all along, I mean, you played the clip from his West Point speech in 2010, this was all, 2009, this was all along a very odd strategy.
Why?
I think best summarized by the Taliban phrase, which is, you have the watches, but we've got the time. And to announce that you're going to surge, but then pre-announce when you're going to de-surge, kind of defeats the whole purpose.
It was seen as fairly successful in Iraq.
It was seen as fairly successful in Iraq and enabling a withdrawal. It would be a success if Obama could withdraw from Afghanistan and leave something equivalent to the messy but relatively stable situation you have in Iraq, in Afghanistan. But I think if you were to look at it objectively, and you mentioned the British involvement there, this has been a lot of money, quite a lot of deaths, mostly from inverted commas friendly fire in the last few months.
Recently,
in particular,
from Afghan allies,
exactly,
unquote.
Afghan allies that we have trained at great expense. Nobody has trained the Taliban. They're still fighting. They have no problems recruiting. So I think if you were to measure it by real on-the-ground measures, this has not been a success. But as I say, bin Laden's death politically makes all of this far less problematic for Obama at home.
Yes, David.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw into Ed's very good point here. What happened after that speech at West Point that you discussed? About a year later, as they were getting ready to think about the schedule for withdrawing those surge troops, and by the way, the surge troops were all supposed to be out within a few weeks from now, they put together a secret committee in the White House whose title, the committee's sort of unofficial title, said it all. It was called Afghan Good Enough. And it was in charge of narrowing and narrowing and then narrowing again the goals in Afghanistan until you could reach that point that Ed just discussed, which was when you could pull the troops out and declare that they've accomplished what their goal was. Well, if you've reduced the quality of the goal, that's a lot easier to go do. And so what we've got now is that the president will be able to say that they halted the Taliban's momentum. What he won't be able to say is whether or not the changes in Afghanistan have been lasting. And in fact, I think the biggest change that you saw take place in the mind of Barack Obama from the time he came into office in the foreign policy sphere is the recognition that you could spend 10 years and $1 trillion doing counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, as his generals proposed, and still not necessarily come up with anything lasting.
Joyce, on the other side of Obama's policy so far in Afghanistan, when and if we get there, do people in the region see a stable Afghanistan or just mayhem down the road?
I mean, that is a major concern, mostly for Arab governments, that if the U.S. withdraws, if the NATO allies withdraw from Afghanistan, it might leave a big vacuum. There might be a Taliban resurgence. Iran might have more influence. There are also questions what's going to happen on the border with Pakistan. I mean, yes, of course, many Arabs, Arab governments, they welcome this administration's effort in diminishing Al-Qaeda and killing most of its leader, but there are many questions what will happen to that region after 2014 withdrawal.
Afghanistan, good enough, sounds like a bumper sticker that a lot of Americans could get behind, though, at this point as well. Let's go to our listeners. Brighton, Massachusetts. Richard is calling. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just basically, we're not fighting a conventional war. We're fighting a very unconventional war against people who don't play by the rules. And so, I mean, traditional combat troops just don't make sense. If we drop them down responsibly, we can still assist the Afghanistan people without us being there having troops. It just doesn't make any sense to keep them there the way we are. I think the way President Obama is fighting this war, pinpointing and doing so in a more precise way, is the way to go.
What would you expect from a Romney administration, let's say in Afghanistan, Richard? Any idea?
Well, besides the fact that he doesn't seem comfortable telling us, because perhaps he might, you know, God forbid, agree with President Obama, I just think he seems like he wants to stay there. He has no interest in getting us out of there. So far as to the point that as far as how much we're there now.
Yeah. Well, you may be right. On the other hand, a lot of Americans seem to want out, or seem to not want to think about that war too much anymore, even though a lot of troops are right there. Richard, thanks for your call. One more, Ames, Iowa. Steve is calling from Ames. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. As a Vietnam era veteran and looking at all this, what I see is the question of Russia's role. It seems like sour grapes with regard to Afghanistan on a lot of Russia's reactions in with regard to trying to, in any way, seem cooperative with the goals we want in the area. If you look at the way Russia has responded to the Syrian crisis, again, and by extension, essentially the Iranian situation, what Russia decides to do has a lot to do with the success or ease with which Secretary Clinton and President Obama can get things carried forward, you know, towards a less explosive
satisfactory
situation.
Outcome there. Yeah, absolutely. Let us look at Russia and China as well, both big, important. Ed, first to you on Russia. What about the way the Obama administration has handled it? We all remember Hillary Clinton with her reset button from Staples that she took over. But there's been a lot of pushback and sort of tough talk toward the U.S. from Russia. And it is, as our caller says, it's right in the middle of lots of efforts to solve problems in Syria, Iran, and elsewhere, and not very cooperatively.
Not very cooperatively. No, I think that Obama, has been dealt a bad hand recently with the re-election of Vladimir Putin.
That's a pretty big hand.
It's a pretty big hand. The fact that the Romney campaign, that Mitt Romney has identified Russia as America's number one geopolitical
foe. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, takes the focus off, you know, the difficulties and the unevenness of the America's relations with Russia in the last few years under
because
the Obama
administration. Because that's a misapprehension of the world, you're saying, and so Obama looks okay by comparison to that description? Or
I think so. I mean, when Obama says, you know, the Tampa Convention was like, you could have watched it on a black and white TV.
Yeah, retro.
You do get a little bit of the 1950s in terms, a whiff of the 1950s in terms of Romney's Russia obsession that I think reflects some of the advisors he's had around him during this campaign. In terms of concrete differences between Obama and Romney. It's the missile defense one that Romney would, you know, put it back in Europe. Explicitly the missile shield to defend against Russia,
not
Iran. And Obama, you know, has these sites in the Czech Republic and Poland that are all about Iran, not Russia. I think that's the key difference. That is a very, very important material difference if a President Romney put it into practice.
In political terms, let me play this. There's that little bit of tape. Famously, this was last March on the eve of a nuclear security summit in Seoul, and the president sat down for a photo op there. This was with outgoing Russian President Medvedev. And he asked for some flexibility on these missile negotiations you're talking about, Ed, and until after the elections. Medvedev promised to transmit the message to Russia's alpha male then, Vladimir Putin, who's now in charge. The exchange was caught on an open mic. A little fuzzy, but here's Obama, then Medvedev.
It's my last election.
Basically.
Yeah. After my election, I have more flexibility.
Yeah. I understand. I transmit this information to Vladimir and understand what
After my election, I have more flexibility. I understand. I'll transmit this information to Vladimir. David Sanger, what flexibility? Republicans have made much of this. What is it on the other side of a successful November re-election that the president might have in mind?
Well, you know, Tom, you remember that great phrase that the definition of a gaffe in Washington is saying something true in public?
Well, yes,
so, you know,
right. What a screw up.
Every president has more flexibility after their election. There are many things that the president, I'm sure, has in mind that he wouldn't think of talking about prior to the election. And one of the big ones that's disappeared, and it fits right into this, is his whole get to zero on nuclear agenda. He has said it wouldn't happen in our lifetime, but he has sitting on his desk, and it has gone no place in the past few months, a proposal that would do some unilateral cuts in the nuclear force without additional negotiations with the Russians on the theory that we may not need all the nuclear weapons we have. The president's
And they're expensive to maintain.
They're very expensive to maintain. But let's go back to that missile defense point that Ed was making, because he's exactly right here. I mean, you need two things to think about missile defense. One is to think about where the threat is that you can protect against. And in this case, the big concern is Iran, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the second thing you need is a map. And putting a missile defense system that is supposed to be aimed largely at a long-range Iranian threat that does not exist yet, it's a long way between Iran and Poland. So what the president has done is moved a system that would float largely in the Persian Gulf, a lot closer to the missile capability that Iran has today. And if the debate actually began to go in the direction that sort of Bill Clinton was trying to take the economics debate yesterday, this would be an interesting set of facts to begin to debate. Why would you put this in Poland if you had some other choices to head off the earlier threat? I think the second big issue that was missing from the Romney discussion, but which is really interesting and is a big difference between them, is China. We've heard Governor Romney say that he would put sanctions on China on economic issues on week one.
Day one.
Yeah. Now, you know, what happens, you know, a few days after that? Well, you know, the Chinese come back. It's a two-way world. And they say, you know, we think we're going to sit out this treasury auction and
don't buy American debt and we're in trouble immediately.
Right. So, you know, the question is, are we living anymore in a world where we can act as a superpower and expect no reaction back? Certainly not. And, you know, I think the president has misjudged the Chinese at moments. I think in 2009, he thought they could be very close partners, first on the economic crisis, then on security issues. The Chinese took this as weakness. And, you know, he learned a big lesson from it that I think has been reflected in the sort of shift toward the Pacific. But the interesting question, if Governor Romney came in, is what, you know, it's the and then what question. What happens after you do those sanctions?
Ed, what do you think about this big fundamental issue that Mitt Romney's chosen to frame it this way? The U.S. was the superpower. It needs to continue to be the superpower, the big dog in international affairs, versus I think most people see President Obama as talking about a big but more cooperative power. Which looks more successful as a posture to you in this century, in this global affair?
I think this is, you know, the in a way, the great surprise of Obama as foreign policy president is that he's actually a realist. I mean, if anybody, you know, could claim to be holding the torch for the James Bakers or the Brent Scowcroft approach, it would be Obama. There isn't that much idealism sort of threading through his foreign policy. It's a sort of ad hoc, practical, first instinct, cooperative approach to problems as they arise, clean up the old problems.
Does realist mean jettisoning the old superpower, large and in charge, we have to lead? Mitt Romney says we have to lead, Americans have to lead.
No, I don't necessarily think it does, but there isn't any grand overarching ideology that Obama has for foreign policy, and I think that's what's refreshing to people, is that it's a problem-solving approach, and it is ad hoc, it's case by case. And he's, by and large...
You're saying that as a compliment, I guess.
I'm saying that as a compliment. By and large, you know, he's probably got a B-plus from most people, not from the Middle East. And I think deservedly so. He handled the Arab-Israeli process a little bit naively. But by and large, even with China, I think he's probably got a B-plus for having grown on the job.
Joyce, peace in the Middle East, in that region, more likely under an Obama administration, Redux or Romney?
I mean, it depends what we're going to see the next 4 years. For Israel, Iran is the ultimate priority. For the Palestinian, they have an economic, a lot of economic problems. They're divided. So the Arabs are busy with the Arab Spring. So if the pieces come together, yes, why not? Obama or Mr. Romney could find an opportunity to push for a peace agreement on a two-state solution that's expiring as we go. So
we're out of time right there. And as Syria burns and Iran moves, Ed Luce, Joyce Haram, David Sanger, thanks to each of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.